Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. On March 16, 1970, Newsweek magazine published a cover story exploring the feminist movement entitled Women in Revolt. That same day, several dozen women filed a class action lawsuit against their employer, the very same Newsweek magazine. It was, in fact, the first such lawsuit by women journalists, and it was an early step along the path to greater opportunities for women in journalism. Today on the program, we'll learn about what led to that lawsuit, its impact on Newsweek, other media outlets, and the workplace in general, and we will consider whether there is still a gender gap in media today. My guest is Lynn Povich. She was one of the women who filed that lawsuit, and she rose from a secretary for Newsweek to a reporter, editor, and ultimately became the magazine's first female senior editor. She has since been editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine, managing editor and senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's been a consultant to the New York Times Foundation, and her new book recounting the 1970 lawsuit is called The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. Lynn Povich, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Glad to have you with us. As we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments for Lynn Povich at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Lynn, you write in your book that it is hard for people today, even many women, to comprehend the social order that prevailed in the roughly two decades after World War II. Help us to comprehend it, because I think to properly tell this story, we really need to set that scene and talk about what the workplace was like, particularly back in the 1960s, leading up to the period covered in this book.
Well, first of all, if you wanted to get a job and looked in the newspaper, the classified ads were segregated by gender. So it was help wanted male, help wanted female. And under female, there were very few jobs that we would call career jobs. I mean, there were secretaries, assistants, nurses, teachers, and possibly a training program at a department store. But that was the law of the land. When we came to work at Newsweek as young women right out of college, we were told, if you want to be a writer, go someplace else. Women don't write at Newsweek. And that was legal to say until the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And even after that act was passed, most of us didn't realize that it really was illegal to say that. We just assumed that that was the way things were. When we were hired, when women were hired at Newsweek, we were hired on the mail desk to deliver mail and then clip newspapers, and then, if we were good at that, to become fact checkers. While men coming out of the same kinds of colleges with similar credentials, they came into Newsweek as reporters and even writers. So it was a very discriminatory system to women, but that was sort of the end of the 50s culture, where women were raised to believe we should be wives and mothers, and men were raised to believe they should have careers.
Could women get reporting jobs in other media, other magazines or newspapers, or was what was happening at Newsweek pretty common?
Newsweek was very specific to the news magazines. Time magazine was exactly the same, and this system of segregating jobs by gender was actually created by Henry Luce when he started Time in 1929, and Newsweek just copied that system. In newspapers, it's a different system. A reporter on a newspaper goes out and reports the story, comes back and writes the story, and is responsible for the accuracy of the story. In the news magazines, the reporters in the bureaus report stories and send files to writers in New York. The writers in New York just write the stories. They don't even do very much reporting. And then the fact checkers fact check the story. So each function is quite separated. There were many women writing for newspapers and even some magazines. Business Week hired women right out of college to be writers at Business Week. And almost all newspapers had women writing for them. Many of them were segregated in what was called then the women's pages, which had to do with fashion and food and style. But we had foreign correspondents like Flora Lewis at the New York Times, or Gloria Emerson, who covered the Vietnam War, and very famous woman in Chicago, Georgianne Geyer, who also covered Vietnam. So there were definitely women writing in newspapers.
one of the interesting distinctions about Newsweek at the time, as you're dealing with this, what is now, you know, obviously discriminatory, was the fact that the publisher at the time, Katharine Graham, was a woman. Was she aware of this sort of circumstance within the walls of Newsweek?
When the day that we sued Newsweek in March 16th, 1970, the editor called Katharine Graham, who was on vacation, and told her that the women had sued. And she famously said, as she reported in her own autobiography, "Which side am I supposed to be on?"
Hmm.
Katharine Graham had been a reporter, a young reporter, early in her life, but when she married Phil Graham, she went home and raised four children. After he died, she stepped in 1963 to run the Washington Post Company, which owned Newsweek. But she was very insecure in the beginning of that position, and she gained confidence later as she grew. And so her question sort of shows the confusion of women. On the one hand, she was a boss and somebody was suing her. On the other hand, she was one of the two women who ran major news organizations, the other being Dolly Schiff, who ran the New York Post. And they were constantly in meetings where they were the only women, where they were dismissive toward, where men were dismissive towards them. And so clearly she also had experienced this kind of discrimination.
How much do you think, whether it was Katharine Graham or others within Newsweek, how much of their perpetuating this discriminatory practice had to do with an intentional design to discriminate? How much had to do with, this is just kind of the way it's always been, we just hadn't even really thought about it?
Well, you know, it was a sort of cultural thing where we, everyone sort of accepted that this was the role of women. The men certainly accepted it. And the women, many of us, sort of thought, yes, okay, that's why we were the good girls. I mean, we were sort of raised to believe this coming out of the 40s and 50s. But when we came of age in the 60s and we were still working or beginning to work or still single and hadn't gotten married or home with children, then we realized, of course, that this not only was this wrong, but we were also confronting our own ambitions that, you know, even though nobody said to us, you should think about having a career, we began to realize that we really liked this kind of work. And so we had to sort of make this transition ourselves psychologically. And many of us did, and some of us didn't. Some women just couldn't make the transition.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is journalist and author Lynn Povich. Her latest book is The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. In it, she recounts the decision she and 45 of her female colleagues made at Newsweek magazine in 1970 to sue the publication for discrimination, the first such lawsuit by women in media. To join our conversation, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. What led you to the idea of filing a lawsuit over this?
One of the researchers, Judy Gingold, was talking to a friend who was a lawyer. And Judy was explaining what it was like at Newsweek, that we were all researchers and the guys were all reporters and writers. And this woman said to her, you know that's illegal. This was in 1969, so it's 5 years after the Civil Rights Act. And Judy had no idea that it was illegal. And so the woman said, call the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission in Washington. And Judy did, and the woman said, yes, it's illegal to segregate jobs by gender. And Judy said, you know, I don't think the men know this. I think we should just tell them. And the woman said, don't be crazy. You know, people with power don't want to give up power. If you tell the editors, they will promote two women, and that will be the end of it. And you have such a clear case of discrimination that you need to sue. And so Judy started talking to her friends. I was the fifth woman she spoke with. And one by one, we started talking to other women and bringing them into this idea that we needed to do something. This was now a moral issue. It was legal what they were doing. And so as agonizing as it was, and Judy did agonize about suddenly having to sue our bosses and confront them, we thought, you know, this is an injustice and it had to be fixed.
You mentioned all the men were writers, all the women were researchers, except there was an exception to that. You were a reporter on the staff, right, at this point?
Yes, I had been working for a very good writer, Harry Waters, who had mentored me and encouraged me. I had done a lot of reporting for him. And he suggested to our editor that I be promoted to write the sort of short features and fashions and things like that. And so I was lucky. Many women had been doing reporting at Newsweek for their editors, and I was just lucky to be working for a guy who really believed in my work and thought that I should be promoted. So when we sued the editors, we sued on the day that Newsweek decided to do this cover story on women's liberation. And when they were deciding to do this in early January of 1970, there were no women on the magazine to write the story. I was a junior writer, but I wasn't yet experienced enough to write a cover story. So they went outside the magazine for the first time in 30 years and hired a woman who was writing for the New York Post, a very excellent writer named Helen Dudar, to freelance this piece. And that's when we realized, as you said, that we had a news peg and we should sue, because the confluence of doing a cover on women's liberation and yet having the women on its staff sue it at the same time was delicious. And many, many papers all over the world picked this up, as well as all over the country. My favorite headline was the New York Daily News, which said, "News Hens Sue Newsweek." And the first line of that story read something like, 46 women, most of them young and most of them pretty, sued Newsweek today for sex discrimination.
It's hard to imagine that now. I mean, it sounds so brazenly sexist. But did people think in those terms back then? Do you suppose folks at the New York Daily News realized what they were publishing?
I don't think so at all. I think that was just how women were thought of and treated. You know, I don't know at the moment that things happen, but, you know, we sort of, you go along with the system until at one point you realize, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this, and then it all sort of seems so clear. Osborne Elliott, the editor-in-chief of Newsweek, said to me later when I interviewed him that the Monday that we sued, he realized right away that the women were right. And this is a man who made Newsweek into a hot magazine in the 1960s by advocating for civil rights and advocating for the ending the war in Vietnam. He was a very progressive man. And yet he said right under his nose, they were discriminating against the whole class of women.
You mentioned the reaction from Katharine Graham and the reaction from other media. What about from the public itself?
You know, we didn't hear too much from the general public, except for, of course, women at other magazines. They immediately sort of pricked up their ears, and a reporter called the women at Time, Inc., which was Time, Fortune, and Sports Illustrated. She called a woman actually at Fortune magazine and said, "Well, the women at Newsweek sued. Are you all going to sue?" And the woman hadn't thought about it. And then she said, "Oh, my God, maybe we should do something." So they started organizing, and the women at Time, Inc. sued 3 months after we did. And the women at the New York Times sort of started to realize, "Oh, my God, there's something, you know, about this suit that is true for the New York Times." And they sued in 1974 and, in fact, hired our second lawyer specifically because she represented us in our suit. So I would say the women in journalism certainly took note of it. And one of the woman columnists said to me not long ago that she thought one of the impacts of the Newsweek suit was that the news organizations were put on notice that if they didn't start treating women better and integrating their staffs much better with women, that something was going to happen to them. But many of them, believe me, were resistant for a long time.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is journalist and author Lynn Povich. Back in 1970, she and 45 of her colleagues filed a class action lawsuit against Newsweek magazine alleging gender discrimination. It was the first such lawsuit by female journalists and an early step along the path to greater opportunities for women in the workplace. She writes about it in her book, The Good Girls Revolt. We welcome any questions or comments you may have for Lynn Povich at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and we'll start this morning with Tim in Charleston. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Ms. Povich, it's great to hear this story. I just had a comment on the, now I didn't quite catch it, New York Post, New York News comment, most of them young, most of them pretty. I think that really speaks to the characterization of, quote, women's livers at the time as being, you know, masculine or ugly or, you know, somehow women that, you know, weren't making it on their looks as women should kind of thing. And so they're commenting about, well, no, it's not necessarily that it's just, you know, brutish women who are seeking out liberation.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that there was a sort of characterization in the media about women libbers as being aggressive and unattractive in some way. And I do think that, you know, when you had a very attractive group, or in the case of Gloria Steinem, for example, a very attractive leader, they sort of glommed onto that.
Boy, you know, you're right. And that just kind of cuts it both ways, then, doesn't it? You...
All right.
If you're not attractive, you're protesting because you're not attractive. And if you are attractive, they focus on the fact that you're attractive.
Yes, and one of the things that the women's movement within the media started to do after that was, of course, eliminate all the adjectives like young and pretty that you wouldn't have put next to a man's name. And many women in the newsrooms started, you know, having policies where the adjectives of brunette and grandmother and divorcee and all of these kinds of adjectives that were applied to women should no longer be applied to women unless they were equally applied to men.
Thanks very much for the call, Tim. We'll go next to Paul in Champaign County. Hi, Paul. Good morning. Paul, are you with us?
Nope. Oh, I'm sorry. Yep. I didn't expect to be gotten to this quick.
All right, go ahead.
I wanted to ask about how the feminist movement of the time, it was a bit incipient, but I think I heard you talk about how Gloria Steinem intervened directly. But I also heard you say that you think today circumstances are still pretty wretched. They're not as, you know, they're not de jure, I don't know the right expression at this point. It's more subtle, but just looking at some of the other aspects of media and participation, et cetera, the statistics on people of color, Latinos, and particularly when you get into ownership, is just ridiculous, and it has to affect sort of the tone, tenor, and just the characterization of our realities for mediating us. So I guess I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, I definitely, look, women have made enormous progress, and they've made enormous progress in the media. I mean, if you can't turn on television without seeing women covering the wars in Iraq or Syria, and certainly women are in middle to upper management. There is definitely a glass ceiling at the top. There are very few women who are running news organizations. Tina Brown became the editor-in-chief of Newsweek in 2010, and Jill Abramson last year was appointed the first woman to run the New York Times. But there still are not women running network news organizations, many newspapers, and so there is still a glass ceiling. But there is also a discrimination that is subtler, and certainly in professions like journalism or advertising or PR or the arts, where the decisions are subjective and somebody can just say, this just isn't good enough. It's harder to pinpoint that something is actually discriminatory or something is just, you know, not that good. And so young women are always asking me, you know, because they feel that, you know, they don't quite understand why they're meeting obstacles at work that they've never met when they were in school. So many young women, as you know, do very well in school, and they come into the work world. And suddenly, and this was true for young women I interviewed at Newsweek several years ago, you know, the guys are getting better assignments, or they're moving ahead faster, or they're getting better pay, and they can't quite figure out why. because this is sort of being called post-feminism, that, you know, we're all equal now, it's a level playing field, and so they don't identify it as gender discrimination. They think, like we did 40 years ago, that they're just not good enough. And for the young women at Newsweek, when I talked to them several years ago, they realized once they found out about our lawsuit that, in fact, these issues are still unresolved. There's still a lot of places where women are discriminated against, but it's not as obvious as when we were told, go someplace else if you want to be a writer. And so I think that's what young women are sort of confronting at the lower end of the ladder, and then at the top, women are confronting this issue of why they're not at the very, very top of mastheads and corporations. We thought it was a pipeline issue, that once women got in the pipeline, they would, of course, get to the top. But it's been 40 years.
Let's go next to Rolana in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning.
And
I just wanted to honestly to thank your guest, because it's because of women like her that I'm in a position where I actually do have options and I actually do have places that I can go and succeed. And that, you know, my 13-year-old daughter, when she grows up, is going to be even in a better position. And it started with women like you. And so I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, many, many women have done wonderful things across the board in the feminism movement. And I do believe that, you know, we owe it to our daughters. That's one reason I wrote this book, and to our sons, to tell our stories and tell our history. Because young women, young people today are very smart, but they often are not required to take history anymore. And yet, I am a believer as a history major that, you know, you can't figure out where you're going unless you know where you've come from. And I do think this is a wonderful book to give our children, because you give it to your mother, you give it to your daughter or your son. It's a great way to read a story and talk about what's changed and what still hasn't changed.
Well, let's get back to that story and that history and talk some more about the repercussions of your filing that lawsuit and what happened to the suit itself. And let's start there. What happened with this initial lawsuit?
Well, initially, everyone came to the table right away. We negotiated and we signed an agreement in which management promised to hire and promote. Osborne Elliott, who wanted to make these changes, went to the business side for 2 years as president. And the men who took over for him were not committed to making things better for women. And so 2 years later, in 1972, we actually voted to sue again. And we were represented by a wonderful lawyer at Columbia, Harriet Rabb. And Kay Graham, at this point, was being sued by the blacks at the Washington Post. And the women at the Washington Post were not helpful, not happy about what was going on there either. So she sent her corporate lawyer, Joe Califano, who later became Secretary of HEW under Lyndon Johnson, up to negotiate with us. And this time we were very specific in our demands. We asked that a third of the writers and reporters to be women by the end of 74, a third of the researchers to be men. That was important to integrate the category and show that it wasn't a woman's job. It was an entry-level job. And then finally, a woman senior editor by the end of 1975. And in August of 1975, a new editor took over at Kosner, and he appointed me into that position.
We talked a little bit about the impact that the Newsweek case had on women in media, at least in other magazines. How about in media in general, throughout broadcast media and other forms?
Well, what's interesting about broadcast media, the National Organization for Women, which was very active, obviously, in these years, they successfully petitioned the Federal Communications Committee in Washington to make sure that diversity was a requirement for television stations. And so you began to see that especially local television stations, but even networks, started hiring women as anchors, as reporters, and things like that, because their licenses were not going to get renewed unless they showed this. And also for people of color, and that's where blacks finally got the opportunity to become local reporters and anchors, and Hispanics and Asians and things like that. So that actually was an in, because they're licensed, it was quite different than just newspapers and magazines.
Do you think then when that happened, that also then impacted how women were treated in the workplace in other walks of life and other professions because they start to see women in media?
I definitely think so for two reasons. If you believe that our media is a reflection of our society, when you see a much more diverse media and people you can identify with, of course you can respond differently. And then those people bring different voices, different ideas, different angles to stories. And so I think that certainly at Newsweek, we had many more stories having to do with issues of interest to women and social issues and family. And you know, Osborne Elliott even said that integrating women into the magazine made it a better magazine.
We're talking with journalist and author Lynn Povich. She's written a book entitled The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. It's her account of efforts by her and 45 other female employees at Newsweek to sue for fair employment practices at the magazine, where all but one of the women were researchers and all the men were reporters. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will take more of your phone calls after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with journalist and author Lynn Povich about her book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll go next to Steve in Watseka. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Very interesting show. I'm in my late 50s, and I grew up in Chicago. And your guest touched on media briefly there. And it seems to me, I recollect, I think she worked for NBC, but her name was Nancy Dickerson, and she was one of the first women that I can recall that had a reporting on a national level on TV. And I was just wondering, number one, if your guest had any recollection of her. And then in Chicago, pre-Oprah days, there was a lady, Lee Phillips, who had her own sort of talk show locally produced, I think out of WBBM Chicago. And I was just wondering if that brought back any memories. And then finally, and forgive my ignorance, is your guest at all related to the great columnist Shirley Povich? And I'll go ahead and listen off here.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, I'll take the last one first.
Okay.
Yes, Shirley Povich was my father. He was a sports columnist for the Washington Post for 75 years. He wrote sports for 75 years, and thank you for remembering him. He was a wonderful journalist. He passed away in 1998, and I actually edited a collection of his columns, which you can get called All Those Mornings at the Post. Nancy Dickerson, I remember well. She was indeed a pioneer and a path leader for women. She was a serious journalist on the air. Her son, John Dickerson, works for CBS today. I'm less familiar with this woman who worked for WBBM because I'm not from Chicago, so I don't know. But yes, there were very many women. There's a wonderful woman who's just now retiring in San Francisco, Belva Davis, who was the first black woman on television in San Francisco for many, many years. And there were many pioneer women who did break through, but they were pioneers, and not many women followed them.
I'm just looking up Lee Phillip myself, Lee Phillip Bell at times, and she, I guess, hosted a show on WBBM, looks like for about 30 years. And, of course, you were talking about Nancy Dickerson. I also wanted to ask you a little bit about your dad, and specifically in relation to this lawsuit. Did you two ever talk about the circumstances at Newsweek at the time, in the midst of all of this?
Yes. As is obvious, I was in the odd position of suing his boss and his very good friend, Catherine Graham. My father was working at the Post when her father bought the Washington Post in 1933, and he was very close to the Graham family and very close to Catherine Graham. And so before we filed the suit, I called him. I was in New York, and he lived in Washington, D.C., and I explained, you know, why we were suing and how this was an injustice and illegal. And my father actually had made a very big point in Washington of writing about the lack of civil rights for blacks in sports. The Washington Redskins football team was the last to integrate, and my father wrote many, many articles excoriating the owner of the Redskins for not hiring black players on that team. And he wrote an award-winning series on the Negroes in baseball, as they were called at the time, and Jackie Robinson and the whole integration of sports. So he understood that as a civil rights issue that, of course, I was right.
Let's take another call. We have Ed on the line from Urbana. Hi, Ed.
Oh, hi. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this exactly, but if you let me say, how do you relate to, say, younger women today? I mean, I think all these things have gone on in the past, like we were saying earlier. You know, history's not studied very much. I think there's, you know, a great lack of appreciation of how much things have changed. And so commonly, you know, a young lady will deny any kind of feminist instinct or, you know, I'm not a feminist. But at the same time, of course, enjoy all the benefits of feminism. How has it come to be that way, and how do you relate to younger women today?
I mean, I am always amazed that, you know, young women don't want to be called feminists, because, you know, it's more a semantic problem. Because if you say to them, do you believe in equal pay? Yes. Do you believe that you should have control of your body? Yes. Do you believe? So when you ask them what equality is all about, they agree. There's something about the word feminism or about the kind of women they associate somehow with feminism, which they find unattractive or unappealing to them. And
since it's been so successful, how you would think that at this point that would be a term everyone would prefer to have.
And I do think, as you said, I found two things very interesting about doing this book. When I interviewed the young women at Newsweek in 2010, two of them were like this. They didn't want to be called feminists. One actually had been raised as a feminist. And yet after they found out about our case and after they talked to us and they understood the context of the movement, they are now happy to be called feminists. They're interested in women's issues. They're writing about women's issues. So I think part of it is ignorance and not understanding the full meaning of what feminism is. And I also find now that I'm out and speaking about this that young women actually yearn to know about the history because they haven't been given it, they don't know about it, and they find it really interesting. And I wonder, as a mother of a son and a daughter, whether, gee, didn't I talk about this enough at home or so on and so forth? And yet I think about my mother's generation and most of us who had mothers, you know, grew up in the 40s and had mothers who were in their 20s, we didn't hear our mothers talk about the suffragettes. So I'm just thinking that, you know, we have to do a better job of talking to our children about these experiences, and certainly once they get into the work world, which I think is different than college. I think what we're facing now in college is that we have, as you know, 58% of college graduates are women. And so we actually have a problem with young men, I think, right now, and sort of their education, what happens to them. But women do very well in school. It's when they get into the work world that things change.
You had mentioned that you had taken some time to speak with current employees at Newsweek, or at least recent women working at Newsweek in recent years, and how in some cases they were facing some practices that they couldn't put their finger on it, but they felt like something maybe was discriminatory, or there was something they couldn't understand why they weren't getting ahead in certain circumstances. Do you get the impression that there are other stories, other instances, whether related to women in the workplace or other discriminatory practices, that seem, because you said that they were not aware of your story and what you and your generation had gone through at Newsweek? Do you think that's the case in lots of places?
I think that many young women have not. I mean, I asked the young women at Newsweek, for example, have you ever taken a women's studies course? None of them had. Hmm. And, you know, they didn't exist when I was in school. So I'm always a little surprised that they don't know as much as I would have thought they would have known. On the other hand, I don't want to say all young women, because there are young women, young feminists who are very active, especially as journalists and writers online and blogs. I mean, there is a very big young feminist culture, but they don't seem to have sort of coalesced around certain issues. And they, unfortunately, don't have the kind of social movement that we had with the women's movement. I mean, we were lucky in that we had a women's movement behind us and was part of us, and we were all excited by this new realization of, you know, where we needed to go and what needed to happen. And I think young women today have been surprisingly apolitical. I do think that the presidential campaign has begun to raise issues for them, that rights that we all took for granted are now sort of threatened across many, many states, especially in terms of women's health and equal pay. And I think that young women are finally waking up to the fact that what they assumed was just the way they were and everything was fine, and beginning to see that that's not necessarily so. So they're beginning to, I think, become more aware of women's issues and try to do something about it.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments for Lynn Povich at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. Lynn, today in our politics, in our national discourse, we will sometimes hear people call for a return to 1950s values, to a sort of leave it to Beaver kind of world. What do you think about that, and what's behind that sort of language or that sort of thought process? And what occurs to you when you hear those sorts of calls, particularly as relates to the story you're telling here?
You know, I think it's very threatening to see, for some people, to see the changes in society. I mean, what we saw in this election was that, you know, single women, people of color, voted for Obama in very great numbers, and the demographics seem to be against the Republicans. And the demographics of this country is changing, and for some people, that's very threatening. I mean, Gloria Steinem once said that there were two periods of retrenchment. One is in the beginning, where women first began to sue, but the second is when they become very successful, and it looks like they're actually going to sort of become totally mainstream or majority or something, and that's the second sort of time that people react in terms of retrenching back to wishing things were the way they were. And I think what you're seeing now in the Republican Party, as reported by the media, is this total sort of questioning about, you know, what are we going to be as a party? How are we going to deal with the changing demographics of our country?
You note in your book Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, at this year's World Economic Forum, referring to an ambition gap, that we, in her words, do not raise our daughters to be as ambitious as our sons. Do you agree with that?
You know, I would say that rather than an ambition gap, I would call it a confidence gap. I think young women are very ambitious. What she was talking about was how they don't put themselves forward and take risks. And I do think that that is sometimes true. I think it's true because they lack a confidence, which is something surprising to me as a mother, because many of us raised our children in recent years to, and especially our daughters, to say, you can do whatever you want, you can be whatever you want, and to be very confident about their skills. And, of course, some young women are very confident and do very well. But too many women, young women, I think, sort of still worry about, you know, being too pushy or being too demanding. And Sheryl Sandberg has some very interesting advice. I mean, she says little things like, you know, when you go into a meeting, sit at the table. Don't stand in the back or sit on the side. When you ask a question, first of all, ask questions in a conference. And if they don't call on you, keep your hand raised. You know, women just tend to pull back a little bit. On the other hand, there is research that shows that women who aggressively negotiate, for example, for higher salaries, are considered sort of too demanding and often, therefore, not as attractive to hire. So there is still this stigma for being too ambitious or too aggressive. It doesn't exist with young men.
Hmm. I wanted to make sure we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that we took a couple of minutes to talk about what's happening at Newsweek now. I figure you've worked there for many years and have such a connection to the history of that magazine now. As that one-time reporter and editor, how do you feel about the magazine's announcement this year that it would cease print editions and move entirely online early next year?
Well, it was a very sad day for so many of us. I mean, the magazine that we loved and was, so influential and important is no longer going to exist as a magazine. And, you know, I'm not sure what its future will be like on the web. I think many of us feel it didn't have to come to this. I know ultimately many things will migrate to be digital. But, you know, there are other weeklies that are quite successful, including Time Magazine and The New Yorker and New York and The Week and The Economist. And so many of us who worked at the old Newsweek felt that, you know, being a good magazine isn't sufficient, but it certainly is necessary. And if you can't figure out what that is, then you surely will fail. And I think that we were excited when Tina Brown took over. I think, you know, it would have taken her a little bit longer to figure out Newsweek, although it certainly was getting better. But I guess the economics at this point were against it. And I think many of us are, you know, I'm afraid that if I say I ever worked at Newsweek, someone's going to say, what's that?
Well, but again, that sort of points to this question of, are there things that are happening in our relatively recent history, within our lifetimes, that are being forgotten? When we talk about the fact that you felt compelled to write this book because, in part, this is a story a lot of people maybe just didn't know about. Do you think there are pieces of our history that we all assume, well, you can find it somewhere on the web, but maybe it doesn't exist in the way that it should?
I think so. I mean, when these young women at Newsweek tried to find out about our case, they couldn't find it, either because it was in an archive somewhere and they didn't want to pay the money to find the archive, or else it just didn't come up in a Google search. And it was so funny because they said, you know, if it's not on Google, it doesn't exist. That's the sort of current mindset. And I felt after writing my dad's collecting my dad's columns and writing that book, that once it's in a book, even as an e-book, it becomes searchable. It is there forever. And I felt very strongly that this needed to be a book in whatever form and platform you want to get it on, because it then becomes in the global digital library of life, and people will always be able to find our story.
Do you think your lawsuit moved feminism into another dimension, as Susan Brownmiller states in your book?
I definitely feel that our lawsuit began a series of lawsuits within the media. It opened the doors to many women after us, many journalists after us. And I believe that the media has a very strong influence on society and is a reflection of society. And so as women became more and more diverse and began to become more reporters and more writers and more editors, it did change the things society talked about, the things, the people that society looked at, the sources that were quoted, and it did begin to change our idea of what the roles for women and men should be.
Do you think it's also changed the way we all look at the world, that just by virtue of having women in more prominent roles and more significant numbers of women within all media, that we look at issues and ideas differently than we would have had that lawsuit and those steps forward not taken place?
I definitely think that when you see women in leadership positions, it allows young women to believe they can do that. A friend of mine said that his daughter has been alive only to see either a woman or an African-American become a Secretary of State, and said to her father, gee, Daddy, can a man be Secretary of State? So to her, that's a possibility now that had never existed for our generation.
Well, how about for your generation, specifically for you? You write that the lawsuit not only changed your life, it changed your thinking about women. How so?
Well, because I think that it brought up my own consciousness about my own personal abilities and ambitions and what I decided I needed to do and wanted to do and could do. And I think that it definitely changed. I grew up with two brothers. I didn't have any sisters. It sort of changed my relationships with women, certainly professionally, in terms of bonding together and organizing and doing something together. It has paved a way for my being involved in women's issues for my entire life. I became the editor-in-chief of a magazine, Working Woman, for business and professional women. I'm on the board of two nonprofits on women's issues, the Human Rights Watch Women's Board and a journalism board called the International Women's Media Foundation. So I actually have spent the rest of my life working for the advancement of women.
And what would you like to see then as, I guess maybe this is the best word to put it, as your legacy in regards to that? I mean, what ultimately do you see as your best accomplishments associated with serving women's rights?
I think that we all have to realize that there are still inequities in our society across the board, and we have to constantly fight. You know, it's never over. People will always resist, and we have to keep fighting for equality for everyone, including women. And I also hope that young people see the advantage of a women's movement, call it feminism or whatever you want. And I also think that there are societal issues that are not just women's issues. The whole issue around work-family conflict is not a women's issue. It's a societal issue, as young men want to be involved with their families as well as work. And so I hope that we can see that feminism is not just about women. It's about all of us, and it includes men, and it includes issues that influence men, like work-family issues. And so that's what I would like to see as the legacy.
Is it harder to address those issues today in some ways because if we're talking about something that may be discriminatory, that's more subtle than it once was? I mean, when we think back to what you and your fellow women sued over at Newsweek in 1970, that was pretty stark. That was pretty dramatic. It seems things are more subtle today.
Yes. I mean, look, there's still obvious discrimination. There's still sexual harassment. I mean, we've read about it,
right,
in these horrible cases in the military, and there's still pay inequity and all sorts of things, hostile workforces. But yes, there is a kind of discrimination which isn't talked about because it's illegal. But there are a lot of companies that are sort of run as old boys clubs, and if you're not in the club, you know, you're not going to get ahead. And some bosses feel more comfortable by having like-minded and guys around them, and some men who respect and like women promote women. I'm a believer that corporate culture comes from the top, and so I really believe that corporations need to change both structurally and also in terms of diversity to attract a much more diverse workforce and become much more flexible for people who have children.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're just out of time, but I want to say thank you to Lynn Povich, who rose from a secretary for Newsweek to a reporter, editor, ultimately the magazine's first female senior editor, has been editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine, managing editor and senior executive producer for MSNBC.com, and a consultant to the New York Times Foundation. Her book's called The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. Lynn Povich, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Craig. It's my pleasure.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. You can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. If you know someone who might enjoy hearing Focus but can't tune in during the day, let them know about that evening rebroadcast. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk about drug courts. They are specialty courts for drug abuse cases, and they're designed to take some steps beyond simply incarcerating a drug offender. Drug courts are empowered to identify ways to help a given defendant face up to and address his or her addiction through supervision, drug testing, treatment programs, and various incentives. We'll talk with Justice Jeffrey Ford, who founded the Champaign County Drug Court back in 1999, and Carolyn Cooper, an attorney and assistant public defender who has written extensively on drug courts and the strategies they use to manage their caseloads. We'll discuss how such courts work, whether they are effective, and what challenges they face day-to-day in their efforts to break the cycle of criminal recidivism. That's on Wednesday's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Jason Croft was our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.